This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
In a time of sluggish economic growth, the favourite way of squaring the circle of spending more but not increasing taxes is to borrow. And we have. Keeping everybody's lights on during the pandemic and homes heated after the Russian invasion of Ukraine has helped send our national debt up from £1.8 trillion to £2.8 trillion in recent years. But the question for the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is how much more debt can we afford? And how much more debt do the markets think we can afford? So, what's the answer to that? Step into the briefing room and, relatively painlessly, together we'll find out. First, I want to understand how the UK's debt level got so high and who we owe the money to. Duncan Weldon is an economist and author of 200 Years of Muddling Through. Duncan, bold first question, how much do we owe in government debt?
Well, the best way to think about government debt is not just as a number, because it will be a really big number. It's to think of it maybe as a percentage of national income or GDP. And in those terms, at the moment, British government debt is about 95-96% of national income. So government debt is roughly equivalent to the entire output of the British economy in one year.
And I want to come on a bit later to some of the history of that debt. But in the first instance, let's talk about what that debt actually is. Firstly, who do you owe all this money to?
OK, so how does the British government end up with a debt? Well, it gets a debt because in any given year, it might be spending more than it's taking in tax. And that difference is the deficit. And that deficit is funded by borrowing. The way the British government borrows is it issues what are called bonds or gilts. A bond issued by the British government, we call a gilt for historical reasons, because once upon a time, they came on gilt-edged paper. Those are basically loans, but unlike a loan, they can be sold on. So if I borrow £100 from the bank, I owe the bank £100. If I issue a £100 bond to you, you can hold on to that bond until the money is due, or you can later sell it to someone else. So we're talking about bonds and gilts. And the question is, who owns, who buys those bonds and gilts? And there are different sorts of people buying British government debt.
Well, let's go through who those people are.
So let's start with the unusual one and the relatively recent one. That is the Bank of England. Over the last 15 or so years, the Bank of England has had this programme known as quantitative easing, or QE, where it has been electronically creating money to buy British government debt. So a big pile of that debt, 25% or so, is owed to the Bank of England. That's unusual. And the Bank of England isn't buying anymore. In fact, it's slowly reducing the number of bonds it owns. When we think about the rest, that it's useful to put them in sort of three buckets. You've got overseas investors, who are again about 25% of the market, sort of foreigners who are buying British government debt. The rest, well, traditionally, the buyers of British government debt, gilts, have been large financial institutions like pension funds or insurance companies, people who want a long-term safe asset which doesn't really pay that much. And they've been a really important source of demand for government debt over the last few decades. But in recent years, the percentage bought by pension funds, insurance companies, these big long-term investors, has been falling. And more of the debt has been bought by sort of what you might non-pejoratively call speculators, hot money, people who aren't thinking, I'm buying this 20-year government bond and I'm sticking it under the pillow and enjoying the interest for 20 years. People thinking, I'm going to buy this and I might sell it later on. And when you've got more hot money in the market, it becomes a bit more volatile.
How old are some of these bonds? I mean, how far back does some of the government debt we've still got go?
Oh, very, very far. Because, I mean, you know, most government debt, you know, it'll be issued for 5 years or 10 years or 30 years. But there are longer term ones knocking out there. You know, there are 19th and I'm pretty sure 18th century bonds still knocking out there, sort of consols. And, you know, the interest rate on them is so low, there's no point in redeeming them.
Well, I rather like the idea of buying a bond maybe that was first issued in the 18th century.
Yes.
If we can get our hands
on it. We did pay off the First World War loan relatively recently in the last 10 years.
Well, now that brings us back to a very nice question, which is what is the actual history of debt? And you've used percentage of GDP as your kind of, as your measure rather than absolute figure. So you talked about the First World War. In times of war, I imagine, or just after, you borrow a lot.
Yes. What's unusual about debt to GDP being up at 95, 96% now is that's come after a long period of peacetime. Traditionally, in Britain, really big spikes in government debt have been associated with wars and the cost of war. So it was over 200% in the aftermath of the Second World War. That was a very, very expensive war. And then the general picture from sort of the mid-1940s, you know, all the way down to the early 2000s was of that number gradually coming down. So on the eve of the financial crisis of 20-odd years ago, it was down to about 35% of GDP. You know, very, very low number just 20 years ago. Still feels strange to me to say the financial crisis was 20 years ago, but there we go. But since the financial crisis, you've had this series of big economic shocks. You had the banking crisis, 2007-8-9, very, very expensive.
So why did we have to borrow a lot then?
We had to borrow a lot for two reasons. Firstly, because tax revenues fell off a cliff, and so the government's annual borrowing picked up, and then you had to recapitalise banks as well. That was expensive. So that, you know, the financial crisis was very expensive. You had, you know, reasonably weak economic growth in the following decades, so you still had a deficit. You had the pandemic. The pandemic was hugely expensive for the government. You know, suddenly, out of nowhere, through the furlough scheme, the government was paying 80% of the wages for millions of people with borrowed money, a big jump in debt. And then straight on the back of that, we had the energy price crisis after, you know, exacerbated by Russia invading Ukraine, when the government stepped in to support household energy bills. And again, that was very expensive. So each of these shocks has sent the level of debt higher.
So we have a combination of relatively sluggish growth, which means that we don't get the revenue in that we might otherwise get in, and then a whole series of shocks, one on top of each other.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, let's talk about repayments and what has happened to repayments, because, of course, we have to famously service this debt. Yeah. I think quite a lot of people don't quite know what servicing the debt really means. I mean, they understand it in terms of they're paying interest on their own bank loans and so on. Yeah. Can you take us through that and why it fluctuates?
So the interest rates that the government pays when it's borrowing depend on, you know, wider interest rates in the wider economy. And this is the really important thing. You know, anyone listening who has ever had a debt knows there are two things that matter when it comes to a debt. There's how much you owe and there's how much you're paying on what you owe. So, you know, owing £100,000, if you're paying 1% a year, then your servicing costs are only £1,000 a year. If you owe only £50,000, but you're paying 5% a year, you're paying £2,500 a year, paying a lot more despite the debt being smaller. So the interest rates matter. And That's what's really mattered here in Britain over the last sort of 15 years, if we look back at it. So the financial crisis has two impacts. The level of government debt really jumps up from, you know, 35% of GDP to, you know, approaching 80. But interest rates collapsed. So we're in this weird position where in the 2010s, despite debt being much higher than in the 2000s, the annual servicing cost of that debt actually fell because the fall in interest rates to less than 1% mattered more than, you know, government debt doubling. But, you know, after the pandemic, what we've seen is interest rates return to more historically normal levels. You know, Bank of England interest rate up there, 4.5% approaching 5%.
Could you quantify, Duncan, how much more we pay in debt interest repayment as a sum now than we did, let's say, at the beginning of these series of crises in 2008?
Okay, so the net interest payable by the British government in sort of the calendar year 2024 was about £81 billion. If we go back 20 years, it was less than £28 billion. You know, we're talking, you know, 50-odd billion pounds, which is, even in, you know, macroeconomic terms, it's a big number.
And what percentage of our of total government spending does that represent?
It's more than 8% of all government spending. So that's roughly 1 in 12 pounds that the government spends is spent on debt interest payments.
Right. Now, all of this, of course, sounds totally catastrophic because these large numbers do. So the next thing to do is just to compare how our debt is faring compared with those of comparable nations, France, Germany, and that incomparable nation, the United States.
So Britain's actually in about the middle of the pack if we're looking at our peers on this. So France has debt to GDP of more than 110%. You know, nations like Italy, more like 120%. Japan's sky high, but Japan is, as always, a special case. Germany, quite a bit lower than us. You know, for 15 odd years, they've had this very, very tight budgetary approach. They've, you know, arguably not spent enough. They've run very, very tight budgets. So theirs is down more like below 80. And then there's the United States, which is also above 100%. And unlike us, is forecast to have ever widening annual deficits for the next 3 or 4 years. And that debt level is skyrocketing higher.
Now, Duncan, one final question on that. Does the indebtedness, higher indebtedness of other countries have any knock-on effects for our debt at all and how much we have to pay for it?
Oh, it absolutely does. Because, you know, if you're an international investor deciding, you know, which bonds of which governments you want to buy to have in your portfolio, you know, it's very often a case of picking the least crumpled shirt out of the laundry basket. And, you know, compared to some other countries, we don't look too crumpled.
Duncan Weldon. Before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast on the BBC Sounds app and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the recent one about ID cards, the one about disability benefits, and the two about Donald Trump's tariff policy.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt, oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Back now to our national debt. And joining me in the briefing room are Merine Khan, economics editor of The Times, and Chris Giles, economic editor of The Financial Times. Merine Khan, how much should the government worry about the current level of national debt?
It's an interesting question depending on said government and what sort of times we're living in. So if we just confine ourselves to the UK, I would say since 2022, particularly September 2022, government debt, the idea that there is a limit to how much debt others want to hold of the UK has become one of the most relevant fiscal policy questions since I could remember, since the financial crisis. And if we're talking about this government, they do very much worry about the level of government debt because they have constructed a series of fiscal rules which are about effectively convincing others that our debt is not a problem. This is the so-called fiscal framework that the Chancellor has. We can get into what those rules are.
We will in a minute.
But for a country like the UK, and let's take the US out of it, thinking about your government debt has become a reality that is sort of inescapable for most developed world economies because the trajectory of this debt, the ratio of this debt has been going up. And the perennial question that people in journalism, economists, analysts ask is, when do we reach a tipping point? And honestly, there are some people who say maybe it will never come and others who are like, it's just around the corner. And you can argue both sides quite convincingly, I think.
OK, Chris, so what do we mean by the tipping point? I mean, I take it to mean the point at which financial markets don't trust us to service our debt. Is that broadly right?
I would think so. That would be pretty catastrophic to cross over that line, because that would mean that you would actually find it very difficult even to sell your debt. And the government has a big deficit. It's currently, the deficit in this financial year is roughly 4-5% of GDP. And so if you couldn't borrow that money this year, you would suddenly have to cut spending very, very rapidly indeed. And that is, it's difficult to do it slowly. Almost impossible would be a real national crisis if we couldn't sell our debt. So that tipping point is a position we just absolutely don't want to get into.
Well, Merine, let's look at the moment. You talked about September 2022, and there's a fairly obvious reason for that, which is September 2022 was the time of the Truss mini-budget. Have I got that right?
Yes.
OK, let's go a bit into that. Mm. What happened during the Truss mini-budget?
We had a localised financial crisis in the UK, which was very much centred about the choices said government was going to make. And during that mini budget moment, Liz Truss made a series of policy choices to cut the top rate of income tax, to provide households with quite generous energy subsidies, and then also to promise more fiscal laxity, which suddenly brought the UK's debt sustainability or its ability to pay back debt in future years suddenly under question.
Under question by who?
By the people whose job it is to fund those deficits. So these creditors that we talk about, that Duncan spoke about, so foreign creditors, those pension funds who actually were very much imperiled by the sharp movements in government borrowing costs, which is why it ended up being a real crisis. It wasn't a crisis that we were shut out of the debt market. Something very specific happened in a certain part of the debt market, which is the pension funds had to very quickly sell a lot of bonds they were holding to raise money. And that basically led to a lot of volatility and potentials for spillovers that could have been much worse. It was all stemmed in the end, but that was a clear reminder. And I think the first reminder this country's had for a very long time that there probably is a limit to your government's choices and their ability to say this is what we want to do with tax or spending policy, because we are very much at the whims of these little pockets of risk inside financial markets.
Chris, the current Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, when she became Chancellor, she set out two non-negotiable rules for government borrowing. Now, could you just remind us what those rules were?
Well, these are the fiscal rules that we hear so much about. And the rule is, the binding rule, so the most important rule, is that this government will not borrow for day-to-day public spending. It's happy to borrow for investment where the return comes in over many years, but not for salaries of government employees, teachers, doctors, police, etc., and paperclips, the consumables that government spends every day. So it wants to cover that with tax revenue and then borrow only for longer term aspects. The second rule that's also important is that the trajectory of debt must be falling. There was a slight change in the measure of debt used, but that's not actually that important. That needs to be falling from the end of the decade. Now, both of these rules are not applied today. They're applied in forecasts at the end of the decade.
Right. Mary, why those rules?
Good question. I mean, they're arbitrary. Every chancellor we've can remember devised their own rules. In this country, those rules are not constitutional. They're not written in any principle. They have been broken every single time a chancellor announces them. We often put them into suspension when we have emergencies like a pandemic. I mean, the funny thing is, we're talking about these amorphous creditors so much. I often talk to these guilt holders and I ask them, what are the fiscal rules? They don't know. This is a signalling device to say that ultimately we've got relatively sensible rules, a sort of variation on themes of other rules in other parts of the world, which just basically show that we as a government are very cognizant that we have to generate more tax revenues, that we have to stabilise the public finances, that we're committed to stabilising the public finances. And so it's almost the specifics don't really matter. I mean, Chris mentioned it, like we've changed the way we measure national debt. In some senses, that sounds like a radical rewriting of, you know, economic statistics. But it's not really, because it's all sort of within the realm of what is sensible. So I think the specifics of the fiscal rules really matter, I think, in the way that we write report about it so much. The headroom, every day it changes because of variables the government can't control.
Well, the headroom, the amount of money she has available.
To meet them or to not meet them. And these are all subject to so much change. But ultimately, the rules are just a signalling device to say we are credible and we're really not like Liz Truss.
So, Chris, it's just psychological. I mean, in a way, it's a game that the Chancellor feels it necessary to play in order to reassure people who may or may not actually know that she's got them.
I think it's a little bit more than purely psychological. So there's definitively a psychological element, but that element is all about trust. It's do you, the public, do you, the investors, trust this government will be responsible stewards of the public finances? And to be a responsible steward of the public finances, it's really a rules of thumb. If this government or any government were to meet these rules persistently over a long period of time, it's very unlikely that the UK would hit any of these trigger points of people losing trust in our ability to service or and ultimately repay the debt. So these are rules of thumb, and trust is really important. So it is psychological, but it's a bit more than that, because if you just set rules that everyone thought, well, that's a bit loose, then you would lose trust yourself. So you've got the rules have to be regarded broadly as sensible.
Okay, so let's just ask you a quick question. How can you tell the difference between the borrowing that you're using to fund your recurrent spending and the borrowing that you're using to spend on capital?
It's not that hard, because the government has to, and the OBR has to assess where all this kind of money is going, and it's allocated and it's based on envelopes. So we had a spending review just a couple of months ago. That was a very important sense in which you sort of allocate numbers to certain ministries and budgets for what they can use for wages and what's going to go into a capital spending. So there are designated statistical definitions for where the money goes. That part's not the difficult part. The part is it's all based on forecasts, which are all based on other variables, interest rates, future growth, productivity, the size of the population. And that's where we're just sort of getting into the fact that ultimately these rules don't have to be hit in reality. The forecasts have to show that they are going to be hit. And that's the point at which we have to sort of scrutinise, you know, all the other elements about what happens, what goes into these forecasts and what goes into these models.
Chris, does that therefore make it a silly question to ask whether Rachel Reeves is on track to meet her rules?
No, I don't think it is a silly question. I think you can say that with sensible forecasting, you can give us an assessment, but it is rather silly to have a particular number with decimal points and the saying she is on track by 9.9 billion, which was the Treasury's number in the March budget, or you get almost every week some forecasting outfit saying that they're not on track by 41.2 billion or some other number. As in the most recent numbers from the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. These are rules of thumb, and essentially, you need to be able to convince everybody that, broadly speaking, you are on track and that you're not doing anything so outrageous with your forecasting. And that's why we have an independent body to do the forecasting, that people basically believe that it's a reasonable assessment that your public finances are on track. Let's not get into the decimal points here.
Let's not. Mary.
Just on this point, so Chris has covered way more fiscal events than I have. My first one was in March 2022 when Rishi Sunak was still Chancellor. And I just went back and looked at what the OBR said was going to happen. At that point, in 2024-2025, the UK's budget deficit was going to be 1.3% of GDP. It's over 5% of GDP. And then you look back over all the forecasts that Jeremy Hunt stands up in the Commons and announces that in future years, this is what our budget deficit is going to be. We almost are always overshooting that. And that's the point at which now we're asking all these questions about whether really the trajectory is always up and we just don't know how to rein in this entire, you know, problem.
Marion, can we look at some foreign comparisons? Duncan Weldon talked, for instance, about Japan. He said that their GDP debt ratio is sky high, and yet they somehow managed to knock along. I mean, can you explain that?
Yeah, so I mentioned before that there's the doomsayers who say the tipping point is coming, we're all going to head to a debt disaster. And then there's the optimists who are like, we can just live like this for a long time. And those optimists usually point to Japan as their case in point. Japan has had a debt to GDP ratio way above 200%. That's double what we're talking about in the UK. But there are very specific Japanese factors about why that debt crisis never seems to happen in Japan, the world's third largest economy. When we're speaking about the premium or what investors charge or the servicing costs, interest rates is just really, really important in that environment. And Japan has had rock bottom interest rates, even as the rest of us over the last couple of years have been actually seeing interest rate rises. They're still very, very relatively low in Japan. That helps the burden that the government has to pay for servicing that debt. And the other one is about ownership. Who owns Japanese debt? And it's the main answer is Japanese people own Japanese debt. The Japanese corporates own Japanese debt. And this home bias is actually really advantageous for Japan because Japanese holders of Japanese debt don't really sell Japanese debt.
So low interest rates and stable debt holders mean that you can possibly afford to run a much higher level of debt. Chris, let's now talk about the states. The Donald Trump big, beautiful bill is going to add really significantly to American debt. Are people worried about whether or not whether there's a tipping point, but whether or not there will become a problem for the American economy?
Yes, the people are worried in the US. I think we need to mention alongside the big, beautiful bill, tariffs, because tariffs are actually offsetting the tax cuts and spending increases in that bill. So their fiscal position isn't getting a lot worse than we thought it was in January, but in January it was terrible. So there was no sign of the deficit, which is bigger than the UK's at 6-7% of GDP. There's no sign of that coming down. Maybe it's going to rise a little bit. And if the UK was running that sort of deficit with that sort of trajectory, we'd be in a lot more trouble. So that shows the privilege the US has of being the most powerful economy in the world, where people, and the reserve currency of the world, where people want to hold dollars. So there is a greater appetite for US debt, even though their numbers look worse than most numbers in Europe, most numbers in Japan, the UK's numbers. So they can keep going for a while. But remember, they are also paying much higher interest rates than they were. And so it means that their public finances aren't in any way looking like they're sustainable. So not in the short term, but in the medium term, something has to change in the US. And the US public is not remotely ready or willing to have the tax rises or spending cuts that would be required to get the US fiscal position, public finance position, into a sustainable state.
Do you agree, Mary?
I'm going to mention two factors, which those of a Trumpian bent would also mention, but I think it's important to think about the potential silver bullets that make the US debt problem and the fiscal budget deficit problem basically go away. One is AI. So the Congressional Budget Office, which is the sort of semi-equivalent of the OBR in the US, they produce independent forecasts, did a sort of modelling exercise, which was based on a big assumption that if AI, and the US is basically the world economy leading in AI, can permanently raise US growth and lower inflation, this debt problem goes away. It goes away so radically that the trajectory of debt, which is now heading towards 200% of GDP, will fall below 100% of GDP.
Now, wow.
There's big assumptions built on that, but let's just keep that in our mind. And the other one that the administration is really bullish about, and we've been hearing about it much more, is stable coins. Now, not to get too much into the weeds of what this is, but this is a form of a cryptocurrency, which is backed by an asset. Most stable coins issued in the world are backed by the US dollar, and that's created demand for US dollar assets, and it's probably going to create a lot of demand for US government debt. So all of a sudden, there could be this entire new constituency of people who need to hold US government debt. I've seen some of these numbers that say we've got a 7% of GDP budget deficit, but in stablecoin world where the dollar is the dominant asset, this all falls to somewhere between 3 or 4. That's huge.
Chris, 10 years ago, I think it was, David Cameron urged voters ahead of the 2015 election not to pass on a legacy of debt to their children. Was that ever an achievable idea? Because a lot of people were seduced by it.
No, not in 2015. In 2000, it might have been, because that's when the UK was running, the last time the UK ran a surplus on its public finances. And if you persistently run a surplus, you could ultimately get rid of all your debt and not pass on a legacy to your children. I think that phrase is actually not a very helpful phrase, because it's really not a problem to pass on debt to the next generation if the servicing of that is not becoming more onerous over time, because you're not really passing on anything more difficult than you've had. And if the economy is growing and your children are going to be richer than you were, and some of the spending you've done has created that debt, has made them richer, it's not unreasonable for the children then to pay for the servicing of that debt, because they wouldn't be as rich as they are without it. So I don't think it's a very helpful phrase, but that does require economies to grow and the debt servicing to be at a reasonable level.
Chris Giles there with Marion Khan. My thanks to them and to Duncan Weldon. And my conclusion, why does anyone want to be Chancellor of the Exchequer? We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeley. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Fenton-Smith. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Our culture can cancel someone in the blink of an eye. Celebrities, sports stars, politicians, influencers and royalty can all find themselves in the firing line. In the age of AI-generated evidence, lawsuits written in legalese you need to pass the bar to decipher, how are you supposed to separate the fact from the fiction? That's where we come in. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and this is Fame Under Fire from BBC Sounds. We'll myth-bust, debunk, pre-bunk, fact-check, and get to the truth behind the timeline. There are new episodes every week, so make sure you listen to Fame Under Fire and subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.